This is Gene reading from the BBC World News for Thursday, February 19, 2026. The lead story is Andrew arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has been arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office. Thames Valley Police confirmed it had arrested a man in his 60s in Norfolk on Thursday and was carrying out searches at addresses in Berkshire and Norfolk. He remains in custody, it said. King Charles III said, quote, "The law must take its course," in response to Andrew's arrest, and that the police had his full and wholehearted support and cooperation. Police had previously said they were considering investigating the former prince over allegations relating to his association with the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. They were reviewing allegations Andrew shared confidential material with the disgraced financier after communications between the two were among files released by the U.S. government. This is the first time Andrew has been arrested. He has consistently and strenuously denied any wrongdoing. Thames Valley Police said that following a thorough assessment, a formal investigation had now been opened. It is also said earlier in February that it was assessing a separate allegation that a second woman was sent to the UK by Epstein for a sexual encounter with Andrew in 2010. The woman, who was not British, was in her 20s at the time. The arrest, which took place at Sandringham at 6 on Thursday, is not in relation to any allegations of sexual offenses. Vehicles believed to be unmarked police cars were seen outside the King's Norfolk estate, where the former prince has been living since leaving his home in Windsor in Berkshire. The BBC understands that Royal Lodge, Andrew's former home in Windsor Great Park, is being searched by police. A number of uniformed officers have been seen beyond the gates. Thames Valley Police said it was not naming the arrested man as per national guidance and warned that as the case was now active, care must be taken to avoid being in contempt of court. Assistant Chief Constable Oliver Wright said, "We understand the significant public interest in this case, and we will provide updates at the appropriate time." Norfolk Constabulary told the BBC it was supporting a Thames Valley Police investigation into misconduct in a public office. The former Duke of York served as the UK's trade envoy between 2001 and 2011, traveling globally and enjoying privileged access to senior government and business contacts around the world. In 2010, Andrew appears to have forwarded government reports from visits to Vietnam, Singapore, and China to Epstein, files relating to the late financier recently released by the U.S. Department of Justice appear to show. The documents also appear to show Andrew forwarded information on investment opportunities in gold and uranium in Afghanistan to Epstein. Under official guidance, trade envoys have a duty of confidentiality over sensitive commercial or political information about their official visits. King Charles said he learned of the news his brother's arrest with the deepest concern. What now follows is the full, fair, and proper process by which this issue is investigated in the appropriate manner and by the appropriate authorities, he said in a statement. Let me state clearly, the law must take its course. As this process continues, it would not be right for me, that is Charles, to comment further on this matter. Meanwhile, my family and I will continue in our duty and service to you all. It is understood neither the King nor Buckingham Palace were given advance warning of Andrew's arrest, which occurred on his 66th birthday. Andrew has always denied any wrongdoing over his association with Epstein. He has not responded to the BBC's request for comment on the specific allegations in relation to the release of millions of Epstein files in January. The former prince previously faced allegations from another woman, Virginia Giuffre, which was settled out of court. She alleged she was made to have sex with Andrew on a number of occasions, including on Epstein's private island, Little St. James, in the early 2000s. The settlement reached between the two made no admission of wrongdoing on Andrew's part. Andrew stepped back from royal duties in 2019 as he said the allegations had become a disruption for the royal family. He subsequently lost his military titles and royal patronage as Giuffre brought a civil action against him in the U.S. in 2022. Andrew was stripped of his princely title in October 2025, the same month Giuffre's posthumous memoir was published, and as fresh details about his association with Epstein came to light. Why has Andrew Mountbatten Windsor been arrested? Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has been arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office. It comes after Thames Valley Police said it was assessing a complaint over the alleged sharing of confidential material by the former prince with late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The former prince has consistently and strenuously denied any wrongdoing in relation to Epstein. Mountbatten Windsor was arrested at about 8 GMT on Thursday on the King's Sandringham Estate in Norfolk, where he has been staying. Officers arrested the King's brother on his 66th birthday. It is understood that neither the King nor Buckingham Palace was informed in advance of Mountbatten Windsor's arrest by officers from Thames Valley Police. We don't know the specifics of the allegations of misconduct in public office being investigated. However, previously reported allegations include that he had shared reports from trade visits, forwarded a confidential briefing on investment in Afghanistan, and passed a Treasury briefing to a personal business contact. BBC News UK and Home Affairs correspondent Daniel Sanford said, "There has to be an assumption that part of this is going to be the sharing of documents within the Epstein files between Andrew and Jeffrey Epstein himself. That's when Thames Valley Police got involved." But Sanford said it was possible that police were not only focusing on emails seen widely in the Epstein files. Firstly, there's 3 million documents in the files, so there may be some the media have missed. But secondly, Buckingham Palace said they would support Thames Valley Police in their inquiries. And that potentially means the police have gone to the palace, or could go to the palace, asking to see evidence of communications between Andrew and others. Assistant Chief Constable Oliver Wright of Thames Valley Police said, "We understand the significant public interest in this case, and we will provide updates at the appropriate time." The force said it would not be naming the arrested man as per national guidance. It is the first time the former prince, who has faced numerous allegations over his links to Epstein, has been arrested. Misconduct in public office is a really complicated offense, writes BBC News home and legal correspondent Dominic Cassiani. It essentially boils down to an allegation that someone who was doing a job on behalf of the British public did something seriously wrong, knowing it to be wrong. There are four elements or factors that police must focus on during their investigation so that prosecutors can later decide whether or not someone should be charged. First, the police must establish whether the person they're investigating was a, quote, public officer, and the incident in question was plausibly part of those duties. If that's agreed, detectives will then look for evidence that the incident in question saw the suspect willfully neglecting to perform their duty or willfully misconducting themselves in some other way. That wordy definition has been a source of legal debate. The next question is whether the action they committed was so bad that it was an abuse of the public trust. That, lastly, if the evidence has passed those three tests, police need to examine whether the person under investigation acted without reasonable excuse or justification. That final question is crucial. It's a fundamental principle of criminal justice that someone suspected of wrongdoing is given an opportunity to put forward their side of the story, and that starts when the police come and knock on their door. Where has Mountbatten Windsor been taken, and what happens next? Police say King Charles's brother is in custody, but we do not yet know where he has been taken. Typically, an initial arrest over an alleged crime of the type Mountbatten Windsor is accused of would be for a few hours to allow searches to be conducted and initial questioning, according to the BBC's Daniel Sandford. Usually the person who has been arrested is then given police bail and told a date to return to a police station for potential further questioning. Mountbatten Windsor's arrest also means the police have the right to take custody photo, his fingerprints, and a DNA swab. If he were to be held for more than 6 hours, it would have to be at a dedicated custody suite, which is part of what is now commonly known as police investigation centers. Cells are basic, but Mountbatten Windsor would be offered a change of clothes, drinks, and food if required. A duty solicitor would be available to him if he did not have legal representation. The timing, length, and number of interviews will depend on what the police know so far and what they learn in the hours after an arrest, according to the BBC's Dominic Cassiani. At some point, a decision will have to be made by the Crown Prosecution Service and Thames Valley Police about whether to charge the King's brother with misconduct in a public office. It could be weeks before any substantial decision is made. What searches are taking place? Thames Valley Police said that, in addition to the arrest, it was carrying out searches at addresses in Berkshire and Norfolk. Unmarked police vehicles were seen arriving at the Sandringham Estate in Norfolk before Mountbatten Windsor's arrest. In recent weeks, he has set up a temporary home at the estate whilst his permanent residence there, Marsh Farm, is being renovated. Meanwhile, BBC News correspondent Helena Wilkinson said she had seen uniformed police officers close to the Royal Lodge in Windsor Great Park. Until very recently, this sprawling property in Berkshire is where Mountbatten Windsor lived. BBC News understands that searches are being carried out at Royal Lodge and that the officers there are to guard the scene. It is thought to be the only address being searched at the moment in Berkshire. Dal Babu, a former Metropolitan Police Chief Superintendent, told BBC News that by arresting the King's brother, officers will be able to assess, that is, access computer equipment, files, photographs, any other evidence. He said they will be able to carry out searches of any premises he owns or occupies, or any other premises he controls, so there may well be searches in other areas as well. What has the King said about the arrest? The King has said, quote, the law must take its course, following the arrest of his brother. In a statement, the King said, I have learned with the deepest concern the news about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and suspicion of misconduct in public office. What now follows is the full, fair, and proper process by which this issue is investigated in the appropriate manner and by the appropriate authorities. In this, as I have said before, they have our full and wholehearted support and cooperation. Let me state clearly, the law must take its course. As this process continues, it would not be right for me to comment further on this matter. Meanwhile, my family and I will continue in our duty and service to you all. Charles R. White House presses Iran to make deal while ramping up military presence. The White House has warned Iran would be, quote, very wise to make a deal with the U.S., amid reports that President Donald Trump is weighing fresh military action against the Islamic Republic. Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt told a news briefing that Trump was still hoping for a diplomatic resolution over Tehran's nuclear program. Her comments came as the U.S. moves a second battleship into the region, and a day after progress was reported at U.S.-Iran talks in Switzerland. U.S. media reported on Wednesday that Trump had discussed attack options with advisers and that a U.S. strike could take place as early as Saturday. Last summer, the U.S. military launched strikes on 3 Iranian nuclear facilities. Trump had not yet made a final decision about whether to attack, and ongoing conversations were described as fluid, sources have told the BBC's U.S. partner, CBS News. Leavitt told reporters on Wednesday, there were many reasons and arguments that one could make for a strike against Iran. She referred to U.S. strikes in June, adding, Iran would be very wise to make a deal with President Trump and with his administration. Although no breakthroughs seem to have been emerged from Tuesday's indirect talks in Geneva, both sides indicated that there had been steps in the right direction. Iran said an understanding had been reached with the U.S. on the main, quote, guiding principles that will frame efforts to resolve the dispute around Tehran's nuclear program. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi added that work still needed to be done. The U.S. said progress was made, and Badr Abu Saidi, the foreign minister of Oman, which is mediating the talks, said the negotiations concluded with good progress on common aims and technical issues. Asked about the Geneva negotiations, the White House press secretary said that Washington and Tehran were still, quote, far apart on some key issues. I think you heard from the administration and the State Department yesterday that there was a little bit of progress made, but we're still very far apart on some issues, Levitt said. I believe the Iranians are expected to come back to us with some more detail in the next couple of weeks, and so the president will continue to watch how this plays out. Levitt declined to say whether Israel would be involved in the U.S. decision. Earlier in the week, Iran said it had reached an understanding with the U.S. on the main guiding principles to resolve their dispute over Tehran's nuclear program. Iran has said it wants to focus the discussions on its nuclear program and the potential lifting of economic sanctions, while Washington indicated previously it wanted Iran's missile development to be part of any talks. The U.S. and its European allies suspect that Iran is moving towards the development of a nuclear weapon, something that Tehran has always denied. The U.S. has been ramping up its military presence in the waters near Iran, and as satellite images show, the Islamic Republic fortifying sensitive military sites. BBC Verify has confirmed the location of the U.S. aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln, equipped with guided missile destroyers and dozens of fighter jets near Iran. The U.S. has also reportedly sent the USS Gerald R. Ford, the world's largest warship, to the Middle East. It is expected to arrive in the region within the next 3 weeks. All U.S. military forces deployed to the region were expected to be in place by mid-March, a U.S. official and a senior military official told CBS. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, posted on X on Tuesday an AI-generated image of the Ford at the bottom of the ocean. The U.S. president constantly says that the U.S. has sent a warship toward Iran. Of course, a warship is a dangerous piece of military hardware, Khamenei's post said. However, more dangerous than that warship is the weapon that can send that warship to the bottom of the sea. Khamenei also accused the U.S. of attempting to predetermine the outcome of negotiations and said that would be a wrong and foolish thing to do. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps has responded to the U.S. buildup by launching a maritime drill in the Strait of Hormuz, located in the Gulf between Oman and Iran on Monday. The strait is considered a vital international waterway and oil export route from Gulf Arab states. South Korea's ex-president jailed for life over martial law attempt. South Korea's ex-president Yoon Suk-yeol has been jailed for life for masterminding an insurrection by trying to impose military rule. Yoon attempted to subvert the constitution by deploying military troops to seal off the National Assembly and ordering the arrest of politicians on December 3, 2024. A Seoul court ruled. His actions fundamentally damaged South Korea's democracy and deserves a harsh punishment, presiding Judge Ji Gui-yoon told the court. Prosecutors had sought the death penalty. Though it was short-lived, Yoon's martial law order left the nation more polarized than ever, and those deep divisions were on full display as the sentencing took place. Huge crowds of Yoon's supporters gathered outside the court hours before the hearing, holding banners reading, "Yoon again." Many of them broke down in tears following the verdict. Also present were anti-Yoon protesters, rallying for him to be sentenced to death. Yoon himself showed no emotion as he learned of his fate. His lawyers alleged that the verdict was not backed by evidence and accused the judge of following a pre-written script. If either side launches an appeal, the case will go up to the Supreme Court, which means it could be months before the verdict is finalized. Yoon shocked his nation on December 3, 2024, by declaring martial law on live television. He claimed it was to protect the country from anti-state forces that sympathized with North Korea, but it soon became clear he was driven by domestic troubles. The opposition, which held a parliamentary majority, left him a lame duck president, while his wife, Kim Kyon-hee, was at the center of various corruption allegations. He rolled back the order within hours after lawmakers fought their way into the National Assembly to overturn it. What followed were months of political chaos, Yoon's impeachment, and a string of indictments against him and other top officials. Former Prime Minister Han Duck-soo was handed a 23-year jail term last month for his part in the insurrection, while ex-Defense Minister Kim Yong-yun, who advised Yoon to impose martial law, was jailed for 30 years on Thursday. Former Interior Minister Lee Sang-min, former Intelligence Commander Ro Sang-won, and ex-Police Chief Cho Ji-ho were among the other officials jailed for what judges have described as an insurrection from the top. Security was tight outside the court on Thursday, with dozens of police buses forming a cordon to restrict public access. Some 1,000 officers were deployed for security operations, local media reported. Inside the court, Judge G called him the insurrectionist leader, although the judging panel found insufficient evidence to rule that he'd planned the martial law order a year before his announcement. Yoon defended his actions throughout his trial, arguing that as president, he had had authority to declare martial law, sounding the alarm over opposition parties' obstruction of government. He maintained that the order was necessary to protect the freedom and sovereignty of the people and to preserve the nation and its constitution. The ruling Democratic Party, which won the presidential election after Yoon's ouster, accused the court of undermining social justice by not sentencing Yoon to death. Yoon masterminded an insurrection that shook the very foundations of our nation, party leader Jung Chung Ray said. Today's decision is a clear regress from the people's revolution. The public will find it deeply unsatisfactory and unacceptable. South Korea has not executed anyone on death row since December 1997, so even a death penalty for Yoon would, in effect, be life imprisonment. Yoon is already serving jail time for abuse of power and obstructing his own arrest after the martial law order. He still faces three more related trials. Several former presidents before Yoon had also been convicted and jailed, but were pardoned after serving just 2 to 5 years in prison, and many expect the same for Yoon. Hamas is reasserting control in Gaza, despite its heavy losses fighting Israel. When a U.S.-imposed ceasefire halted the Gaza war last October, Hamas's war for survival against Israel switched into a battle for control at home. The war had left the group's disciplined military units shattered into guerrilla forces, and most of its leaders killed. Gaza's buildings and infrastructure were largely destroyed, its population displaced, and its economic life in ruins. More than 72,000 Gazans were killed by Israeli attacks during the conflict, the Hamas-run health ministry says. 4 months on, Gazans say Hamas is again extending its control over security, tax revenue, and government services, raising questions about its long-term strategy and whether it is prepared to give up its weapons and authority, as now required under the second stage of Donald Trump's peace plan. Hamas regained control of more than 90% of the areas where it is present, said Mohammed Diab, an activist in Gaza. Its police and security agencies have returned and are now present in the streets, controlling crime and pursuing those it labels as collaborators and people with opinions. Citizens must go to the Hamas authorities for identity cards or health procedures, and it is also reasserting control over the judiciary and courts. At markets across Gaza, stallholders describe regular police patrols and a renewed iron grip on official fees and taxes. The markets are quiet, but the municipality keeps pursuing us for rent, one stallholder said. All those we spoke to there about Hamas control in Gaza asked that we hide their identity. Every single day they come to us aggressively, with the same demands and the same determination, saying if we don't pay, they'll throw us and our goods into the street. They're asking for 700 shekels, or $225. None of us can afford that. The stallholder, who spoke to our colleague in Gaza City, said he and his family of 12 had been displaced from Sujaya to the east of the city, where he used to run a shop. Sujaya today is a flat wasteland of rubble. Every day the municipality comes, said another man selling cigarettes nearby. Let them count the stock and the sales, cigarette by cigarette, and tell me, should I pay them or feed my children? Since the ceasefire, food and some other basic goods are flowing into Gaza more freely. The few key traders with a license to bring them in from Israel say Hamas have reimposed strict control over taxing the imports. One trader, who agreed to share details anonymously, told us force was used against those who refused to pay. The taxes imposed by Hamas depend on the type and quantity of goods, but prices start at 20,000 shekels and above, he said. If a trader refuses to pay, force is used, and in some cases he is kidnapped or threatened. No one can avoid paying taxes on goods. He told us that traders used a code word for Hamas when discussing tax payments so that Israel wouldn't learn that money was being siphoned off to the group. Hamas now has a database of all the traders who import goods into the Gaza Strip, said the activist Mohammed Diab. The trader pays in cash, not through bank transfers, so that the flow of funds cannot be traced. It is gradually restoring the system that was in place in the past, but away from the spotlight, so it can't be monitored. A Hamas spokesman, Hazem Qasem, said the Gaza Strip was in a state of emergency and that exceptional measures were required. Some traders maintain links with the Israeli occupation and attempt to generate excessive profits, so administrative bodies sometimes need to act firmly with traders who refuse to cooperate or meet required obligations, he said. This is purely a governmental matter and has no relation to Hamas. Gaza's government has been run by Hamas since 2007. Money is crucial to the group's grip on power, to pay salaries and, the Israeli army alleges, for its ultimate goal of rebuilding its war machine. Hamas looks at the ceasefire as a time to regroup, to fight against us, said Lieutenant Colonel Nadav Shoshani, spokesman for the Israeli Defense Forces, or IDF. This is why it's crucial to see them disarmed, because they've made it clear that if they have weapons, they will use them sometime in the future. The Israeli army says there are daily attacks against its forces by Hamas. 4 Israeli soldiers have been killed since the ceasefire began. Hamas, in turn, points to repeated Israeli attacks, which Gaza's health ministry says have killed 603 Palestinians. The IDF recently released grainy footage of several figures running through Gaza's debris, who it identified as armed terrorists, approaching troops in the area of Gaza temporarily controlled by Israel under Trump's peace plan. Asked whether 2 years of intense military conflict had failed to achieve the destruction of Hamas's military capabilities, a key Israeli war goal, Lieutenant Colonel Shoshani said the group had been heavily diminished but was now trying to rebuild. This war is not done until Hamas is disarmed, he said. There is an agreement now in place, and we expect that to happen. If not, there are a lot of tools on the table to make sure it does happen. Trump's new Board of Peace, comprising the heads of state from many countries with a stake in Gaza's future, will hold its first meeting in Washington on Thursday. The next stage of Trump's plan for Gaza, including its reconstruction, hinges on Hamas's disarmament. But negotiators are still inching through the detail of what the handover of weapons would mean in practice. Who would Hamas hand weapons over to? Which weapons would they hand over? And how would that be verified? I believe we are capable of addressing the issue of weapons in a way that removes the occupation's pretext to renew the war and is also compatible with President Trump's plan, Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem told the BBC. But Hamas, ideologically committed to fighting Israel, has deeply rooted and well-armed membership across the Gaza Strip. Verifying its full disarmament will be difficult, and some in the group have reportedly demanded they be allowed to keep personal weapons to defend themselves against enemies at home. When the fighting with Israel stopped in October, Hamas immediately turned its guns on rival clans who had begun to take advantage of the chaos to extend their power in Gaza City, Rafah, and elsewhere. Footage of the crackdown, including summary executions of blindfolded rivals in the streets, was released to the public. Israel's leaders have rejected the idea of Hamas keeping personal arms and have applied pressure on the group to disarm by threatening a return to war. In the meantime, an international stabilization force to take over security in Gaza remains in limbo, and the new Palestinian Technocratic Council, meant to take over the running of Gaza's civilian affairs, is waiting in Egypt. Earlier this month, Hamas said it was ready to transfer authority and governance in all fields to the new Technocratic Council. But the Gaza activist Mohammed Diab said there were few signs that Hamas was preparing to hand over power. On the contrary, he said, we heard last week that Hamas carried out large-scale appointments to vacant positions in the government sector and announced them on social media and official platforms. Hazem Qasem denied any new government recruitment, saying that any appointments would have been technical, low-level positions that did not interfere with the handover of power. Critics have questioned whether they are an attempt to retain influence inside any future Gaza administration. The recent transfer of medical cases out of Gaza through the newly reopened Rafah crossing also signaled the intention of Hamas to remain in control, despite the new process being designed without the group's involvement. One of those present at an evacuation point run by international aid organizations near Nasser Hospital reported that Hamas ministry officials had shown up on the second day of evacuations to help supervise. This is now the make-or-break moment for Trump's plan, which has so far kept on track by relentlessly pushing forward past hiccups and delays. Despite repeated threats of a return to renewed fighting, if Hamas does not fully disarm, some in Israel believe the most effective pressure on Hamas leadership might actually come from moving forward with the plan without them. Ground has already been cleared in Israeli-held areas around Rafah ahead of a reported U.S. plan to build new housing facilities for some 200,000 Gazans with the promise of food, water, and medical support to tempt people across the yellow line from Hamas-controlled areas. Crossing into the large swaths of Israeli-held territory around Gaza's perimeter is seen by many in Gaza as siding with the enemy, and very few have so far made the journey. But Gaza's population is a key source of Hamas's revenue and control. After 2 years fighting Israel for control of the land, the battle for Gaza's people might just be starting. As Trump retreats from climate goals, China is becoming a green superpower. How the world's biggest carbon emitter is now at the helm of a renewables revolution. China has created a desert that no longer just reflects the sun, it captures it. Aluminum soaks up the rays on the golden dunes of Inner Mongolia, transforming one of the harshest landscapes into one of the world's largest solar farms. Xin Guyi, who has lived here all his life, seems to welcome the change. It used to be so dry, and the desert was getting bigger, he explains, as he mixes feed for his small flock of sheep after bringing them in from the cold. For decades, Xin and thousands of other helpless farmers in these parts watched them grazing lands shrink. Vegetation thinned, topsoil blew away, and the land lost its life because of overgrazing and rising temperatures. The solar panels, scientists find, act as shade and windbreaks to protect the grass and restore the land. It doesn't stop the desert, but there is modest impact, and that gives Xin hope. Wind and solar energy are abundant in Inner Mongolia. We can contribute to our country. That sentiment may not be shared everywhere, but Beijing's determination to turn China into a renewables superpower is now evident across its vast landscapes. In Gansu and Xinjiang, rolling hills and open plains have morphed into massive wind and solar bases. Shimmering silicon panels sit underneath turbines capable of generating enough electricity to power tens of millions of homes. China, which is still the world's top carbon emitter, has been building an unrivaled green energy grid. The country's leader, Xi Jinping, told the UN in 2020 that China would aim to hit peak emissions by 2030 and carbon neutrality by 2060. This goal now appears to be within reach, with analysts from Carbon Brief saying its CO2 emissions have been flat or falling for 21 months. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's White House has been peddling back American commitment to green energy. Last week, it reversed a key scientific ruling that supports all federal action to curb emissions. So Beijing finds itself in an unexpected position at the helm of a renewables revolution. This has been driven by both Beijing's ambition as well as the competition that it unleashed, so much so that there has been an oversupply of panels, key components, and solar power. This has sparked price wars and a sharp decline in electricity rates, which has battered Chinese firms in the renewables supply chain. The speed of the transition has raised concerns that opposition from locals and environmental questions have been swept aside, while communities that powered its coal industry are being left behind. It has been an extraordinary expansion. Back in 2010, China was generating less electricity from the sun than six other countries: Germany, Spain, the U.S., Japan, Italy, and South Korea. Global Energy Monitor, which collected data, says once smaller solar projects, such as panels on top of homes, are taken into account, China's total solar capacity is in fact already 1,063 gigawatts. China's Communist Party has done this before, kicking off a massive economic transformation when it opened up the country for trade in the 1980s. The result changed the world. As a land of farmers turned into a formidable manufacturing and industrial power, it needed energy and lots of it. Coal was cheap and plentiful, and soon the world's factory became a fossil fuel-burning polluter. China overtook the U.S. as the biggest producer of carbon dioxide in 2006. Now China is transforming again, after directing billions in state subsidies and loans at becoming a renewables superpower. Beijing is focused on three key industries: electric vehicles, batteries, and solar panels. Already, China makes more solar panels than the rest of the world combined. In Xinjiang, which is a key part of this supply chain, rights groups and the United Nations have alleged forced labor and grave human rights violations, all of which Beijing denies. And yet, cheap Chinese-made solar panels are now everywhere, from rooftops in Pakistan to Jamaica, revealing just how indispensable China has become to the world's green energy goals. This has frustrated the West, especially the EU, which has long accused China of resorting to unfair trade practices by manufacturing too much and pricing out competitors. But today, one out of every seven solar panels produced worldwide is made by a single Chinese facility, according to the International Energy Agency, or IEA. Oversupply has also become a domestic challenge. Solar manufacturers have been cutting prices to stay competitive while investing to keep up with the latest tech and rising raw material costs. The result? The country's top solar panel makers predicted they would lose up to 38.4 billion yuan, or $5.5 billion, for 2025. Nikkei reported last month. Six provinces reportedly canceled 143 wind and solar projects with a combined capacity of 10.67 gigawatts in the second half of last year. Beijing has been stepping in to curb the glut, but waste and storage remain big challenges as China's grid, which still relies on coal and thermal power, transitions to absorbing the volumes of solar and wind power that is being generated. This transition is happening in China much faster than anywhere else. China has added more capacity for generating solar energy than the rest of the world combined for several years. The same is true for wind power. Some experts argue that China is so far ahead in renewable tech that it could take other countries decades to catch up. It's a resounding victory for China, says Li Shu from the Asia Society's Climate Hub. Their lead is so significant and so systematic, it's not a question of whether other countries should work with China, it's how. If you are a country still debating whether to work with Beijing, then you will be increasingly left in the dust. Even in China, there is often little choice but to go along with Beijing's plan. In the southern province of Yunnan, the lush mountains of Funing County were once home to one of the world's largest tea-growing regions. Now the beloved tea crops in Pahao village are being replaced by one of Xi's new economic forces, solar panels. Large industrial drones buzz overhead, deploying panels into position. All over the hillside, workers are busy reading installation guides or hammering the metal into soil. Watching the scene is Duan Tian Song, a tea farmer. "My heart aches. I cannot sleep at night thinking about this." He holds up leaves shed by the few tea plants that remain among the solar panels. "Look at this land. It was a great green tea farm, and now it's like this," he says. He worries that uprooting so many tea plants to install panels has loosened the soil, raising the risk of erosion. In other places where they cut trees, they've already caused landslides. Anxious about the dangers, the 35-year-old has pleaded his case to local officials, but he says he has received no reply. "I do not understand why my local government wants to introduce this." Duan waives a contract, which says the village agreed the land could be rented for other purposes. They were not told it was for a solar farm, he says. 33 villagers have signed it, but few of them use the land to grow tea, Duan says. He has not signed it. Work progressed anyway, and we saw the China Energy Engineering Company installing solar panels. We asked the company whether the villagers were consulted before they began work, and for evidence that the land was obtained legally, but we received no response. It's hard to see Duan's resistance slowing down the activity all around us. The hill is already covered in poles or panels, and this is only one of about 300 solar installations across Yunnan that began in 2025 alone. China is in a hurry. When that happens, few things can stand in the way of the Communist Party's ambition. In the late 1990s, it relocated more than 1 million people, by some estimates, to build the world's largest dam on the Yangtze River, despite opposition and environmental concerns. In today's China, it is even harder to measure the number of protests against these projects. Searches on Douyin, China's TikTok, yield videos of villagers protesting against solar projects on their rooftop or on their land, but they are quickly stifled and then censored online. They are usually opposed to losing their farmland or unhappy with the compensation offered. Companies that want to create large solar panel installations must submit a thorough environmental report, but smaller solar parks only need to provide basic paperwork. Scientists say that the impact of installing solar panels can be mitigated with careful planning and by working with farmers to share the land. Concerns do exist about the pace of change and its longer-term consequences. China's electric vehicle and Lotman battery makers are powered by its mining of rare earths, for which China is paying a steep environmental price, our earlier reporting found. It is also not clear what plans Beijing has for the millions who work in the coal industry, which it wants to phase out. But frank warnings are rare in China, especially as projects are approved by local governments eager to show they are doing their bit to support Beijing's renewables push. That push is certainly starting to pay off. Clean power has grown fast enough to cover all the increase in electricity demand in China, and then some, says Xi Xing from the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air. Fossil fuels are being pushed out of the mix. This is the first real sign China is approaching a structural turning point. And yet China is running two races at the same time. It is trying to keep the lights on for the world's second largest economy and its 1.4 billion people while building renewables capacity that can replace coal. That is one of the reasons the country is still relying on fossil fuels and building coal plants. China is using more power every year, and coal was still responsible for generating 50% of that in 2024, although the rapid growth of wind and solar power means they were contributing 18%. But for some, the transition to a greener China feels like yet another change they cannot keep up with. This has been Gene, reading from the BBC World News for Thursday, February 19, 2026.